Hi, this is Roger Glover of Deep Purple, and you are lucky because you're listening to the Mark After Dark Show.
Mad. Mark After Dark. The man that hates everything except the real thing. Coming to you once again live on the air. Tonight on the program is the real thing. The one and only Roger Glover, bassist of Deep Purple. Deep Purple's last album, Rapture of the Deep, came out in 2005. When can we expect the next Purple album to come out, and what will it be called?
Between now and 2030.
Oh, okay.
No, actually, we were going to make one this March, this February-March period.
Mm-hmm.
Because we actually do want to make one. It's just that we're living in different parts of the world makes it very difficult to get together on a spontaneous basis.
Mm-hmm.
Everything has to be worked out to sort of military precision.
Mm-hmm.
And having been on the road for a lot last year, you know, everyone's kind of jealous of their downtime, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with families and stuff, finding time to actually convene as a band, just even for a writing session, is not only difficult, it's also expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And since albums don't make any money these days, there's this kind of, you know, there's a part of the band management thinks that what's the point of making an album?
Mm-hmm.
It's a losing prospect financially.
Yeah.
But it obviously depends on how much you spend making the album.
Yeah.
If you can make an album on a budget, then you stand much more of a chance. But it's very difficult to make an album on a budget if someone lives in Portugal, the other lives in America, I live in Switzerland, the others live in England. Mm.
Well, of all the Deep Purple albums in the last couple of years that feature Steve Morse, from the 96 Perpendicular to the Abandon album in 98 and Bananas in 2003, and then, like we talked about, Rapture of the Deep, which one would you say is your favorite? That sticks in your mind and go, that's the one.
It's got to be Perpendicular.
Wow, really? Well, why Perpendicular?
Well, you have to... There are several strings to this answer.
Mm-hmm.
One is that I've always wanted to be in a band where you can have fun and
mm-hmm.
write songs and have fun doing it. And you think that's easy, but it's not, actually.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways of doing that is if you share everything. If someone's pushing for their song because of greed or jealousy, or someone says of an idea that you've brought up, that's not very good, you kind of take it personally, because it's actually very hurtful to something you've created for someone to dismiss it. If they're dismissing it because it's a bad idea, then that's fine. In fact, that's good. You need that. You need that kind of feedback. But if you feel that they're dismissing it because they're pushing their song and they want their song instead, then that's a negative feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the only way to overcome that, especially if you're in a jamming band, which is what we are, songs don't get written. They just evolve out of
mm-hmm.
jams. We wanted to go back to the original way Deep Purple was. When I joined them in 1969,
yeah, we'll get
we realized that the kind of music we were playing back then was not simple pop music. It was rock music, and therefore the way Ian Paice played the drums was as much a part of the writing of it as was the riff or the words or the title or whatever.
Of course.
And so we shared everything, and those first four albums was a five-way split.
Mm-hmm.
And that was absolutely great. Because it took all that negativity out, and you could, you know, be free. Well, after Ian Gillan and I left Purple in 73, and David Coverdale and Glenn Hughes came in, Richie changed it. Because I think he felt he wasn't getting enough of the credit for having written, you know, the majority of the riffs of
mm-hmm.
the early four albums. He didn't write all of them, and a lot of I wrote a lot
of course.
Deep Rock, for example. But... by the time we got to Who Do We Think We Are, he didn't really want to play anyone else's ideas. He just wanted to play his own,
mm-hmm.
which made for, you know...
Quite a problem.
And, of course, that, you know, it all
split
went
the
up
band.
In smoke,
yeah.
73 anyway. So when Richie left and Joe came in the band just for a brief period, just to sort of reassure us in a way that we could carry on without Richie, because we weren't that sure of that. I mean, I don't think anyone else was that sure. They thought if Richie left, that would be the end of the band. And the way it happened, we were actually determined to carry on. And so after Joe, we found Steve, and the first thing we did when we started our first writing session was say, let's revert to the five-way writing split. And so we did. I was talking to, I don't like to name drop, but I was talking to George Harrison about the Traveling Wilburys. And asking him what it's like, you know. And he said, it's great. We just basically stand around the studio and we've got a few guitars between us and someone says, hey, let's do a sort of Bo Diddley type song, or let's do a Chuck Berry type song. And they'd bash out a couple of simple chords, and it was all very simple and very fun. And there was no hang-ups about trying to prove themselves. I mean, God, you know, they were all legends.
Yeah.
And it was pure fun. And I always wanted to be in a band like that. And one of the first days of the Perpendicular sessions, I found myself literally standing around in the studio with four other guys. There were a couple of guitars around, and that atmosphere prevailed. And that was something I thought I'd have to leave Deep Purple to attain. And here I was in Deep Purple and enjoying it. So that was a very happy album. And you notice it, I think, in the playing. Everyone's playing improved. Pacey suddenly found himself again. And John Lord flourished. He was free to, you know,
kill him
lyrically. Poof. And I made more progress as a bass player in that few weeks than in years of touring. Just through Steve's you know, help and encouragement. And it was just a magic feeling. We could not stop writing songs. It was just...
That's amazing.
It was so flowing. And I think it was a real departure. It was, you know, the most, people say, what are the most important albums? To me, the most important albums are the ones that herald a new era. So for me, it was Deep Purple in Rock is the album that defined us back then. Yeah, and it's not about sales. Machine Head sold more, and so did Made in Japan, but Deep Purple in Rock to me is the definitive album of that time.
Okay, well.
And then Perfect Strangers is another.
Oh, well, definitely. I agree with that, totally.
Yeah. And then Perpendicular.
Okay.
You know, there's a few wrong courses on the way, and there's a few changes of lineups. But to me, they signal, you know, a new gear. We get into a new gear now.
Okay.
And Perpendicular was like, it was brave. We did things we'd never tried before. There was no feeling about, can we live up to the past, you know, which can sometimes...
Yeah. What would you say was the defining moment in time that got you to want to play music and make it your life?
There were a couple.
Well.
There were a couple. One was skiffle music. You know, I'm old enough to know what the world was like before rock and roll. And unless you were into big band jazz or trad.
Oh, I love it. I listen to all of it.
I am now, but I wasn't then.
Yeah.
As a kid, it was old person's music.
Yeah, well, my father used to listen to this radio station back in when I was a kid, and they used to play big band like the Andrews Sisters and Glenn Miller and Duke Ellington, and I love that stuff. Totally think it's like some of the best. Even though I do like my hard rock, I do, and I like my blues and country, and I like, but that stuff is great, no doubt about it.
But put yourself back in time to an 11-year-old boy or a 10-year-old boy.
I do.
Growing up in London, that was boring stuff. And what you heard, I mean, there wasn't much on the radio, really, but somehow things filtered through. You heard a lot of novelty songs in England, people like Max Bygraves, and the war songs were still big. Vera Lynn and Gracie Fields were still big artists, and Johnny Mathis and Perry Como and Johnny Ray, that kind of, well, Sinatra.
Yeah.
That kind of era, to a young kid, was boring. And when I first heard skiffle, it was actually, my parents had a pub, and I crept down one night because they had a skiffle band playing in the bar, and I crept down the stairs. I opened the door from the private part to the public part, and the band was set up right there in the corner where the door was. So I just opened it about an inch and looked through. And what I saw was, first thing I saw was a wash tub. It wasn't a wash tub, it was a tea chest base. You know, broomstick with a bit of string going to the upturned tea chest. And then about, must have been a dozen guitarists all playing different guitars and ukuleles and whatever, all strumming away for all they're worth. The drummer with a washboard and cymbals and hooters and cymbals and gongs and God knows what, anything but a drum kit, in fact, making a racket. And they're all hollering away and all singing to their heart's content. And the energy was just amazing. So I just really got into skiffle. And Lonnie Donegan came along.
Mm-hmm.
And Lonnie Donegan was very important to British musicians because he was there before rock and roll.
Wow.
But he signaled, that he heralded rock and roll, if you like.
Yeah, you're not the first person to mention him.
And it drew on the same sources. It drew on the old blues music and the real grassroots music of America. And so it just seemed like a natural thing. I mean, from skiffle to Jailhouse Rock wasn't that big a leap. You know, they still had that same energy, that still manic kind of thrust. And so that skiffle band, I think that evening was one of the major things. Later on, I remember being on holiday somewhere when I was about 13, I think, and I heard Peter Gunn in a jukebox in a fun fair. And the riff came in, Duane Eddy's riff, ding, 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 ding. I thought, oh, that's a cool riff. I didn't know what a riff was, but I thought, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
But then the bass came in, playing that same riff. And, of course, being a jukebox, the bass was really loud. And it blew my socks off. I thought, what a mighty, mighty sound. What a thunderous sound. It was great. I was so turned on by that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been other, you know, certain songs. Apache by the Shadows was a big turning point. Everyone, you know, growing up wanted to be in a band and wanted to be like the Shadows. And I was in a band, and we did, you know, look like the Shadows, and we had the Shadows movements, and we played the Shadows songs, and so it was very, Shadows were a huge influence on me.
And you were a bass player in that band, I imagine.
Yes, I was. I was always a bass player, simply because when we first started the band, one guy had a real electric guitar, so he was obviously the lead player.
Mm-hmm.
And the other guy knew a lot about chords. In fact, he taught me chords, so he was the chord merchant, which left only the bass. So I thought, well, I'll take the two top strings off my Spanish guitar and put a pickup on it. And we all plugged into the same amplifier. It must have sounded horrendous, but it was enough to, you know, keep us going. And yeah, I like the bass.
Yeah, well, of course.
Because of Peter Gunn, but I felt it was more my calling, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You first met Ian Gillan in the mid-60s when he joined Episode 6. What was that first meeting like? And did you think you would still be working with him years later?
Yes, it's all gone according to plan.
Well, Episode 6 debuted, I hear trumpets blow on the TV show Top of the Pops. Was this the first time you were on TV, and what was that experience like?
Yes, it was the first time. We had a single out before that. Our first thing was called Put Yourself in My Place.
Yeah.
Written by the Hollies.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely zero happened to that. I Hear Trumpets Blow was an American song. It had a catchy chorus. It was very much of its time.
Mm-hmm.
The ba-ba-bas and the vocal
harmony.
We were a vocal harmony band. And yes, we had high hopes for it, and everyone seemed to like it. And going on Top of the Pops, of course, was a thrill.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. I mean, I suppose my first impressions were, you know, this is TV. This is what it really looks like. You know, you get used to seeing it on a little screen, and you're there in this big room with all these technicians running around and cameras everywhere and people talking. You're actually almost ignored until you get to your performance. Right, stand there, you know, shut up. We'll get to you in 5 minutes. And you, okay. You're part of another machine. And TV is not something I particularly like doing anyway, because TV's always got that kind of weird atmosphere to it.
Wow. I've done a lot of TV.
People think they're, you know, God's gift to the world. Okay. Maybe that's a little cruel.
Well, what was your impression of the original Deep Purple and Nick Simper, the bass player you replaced?
First, I heard about Deep Purple was I was best friends with Brian Connolly of the Sweet.
Wow.
He lived very close by, and we used to hang out together. And he once told me, he said, "Oh," he said, "there's this band Deep Purple." I said, "Oh, I've never heard of them." He said, "Yeah." He said, "They all wear black, and they've all got dark hair, dyed dark hair black, and they're really mysterious." And that was the first time I'd ever heard anyone talk about them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty much about the same time as I joined. I mean, it might have been a month before.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got the call, and we met them. And I was thinking about this when I first saw Richie and John, who came to an Episode 6 gig to check us out. And what I saw was these two dark, mysterious figures. And yeah, all their hair was bouffanted up and dark. And
mm-hmm.
And I thought they looked like gangsters, you know. And Episode 6, we were a kind of school band, you know, we were green and innocent by comparison. These were two people from the real world. And I was, you know, I didn't actually get to meet either of them that night. It wasn't until later, I mean, maybe a week later, Ian Gillan accepted the job, and they were looking for a bass player as well. And so Ian and I went down to John Lord's place to play him some of our songs, because Ian and I were a songwriting partnership. And he said to me, he said, "You know, this band, they've had a hit in the States." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, and they're looking for songs." "Ah." So he said, "Do you want to come and play some of ours?" So that was the day we went to John Lord's flat, played him some of our songs, which he didn't like. And he played us Hallelujah, and then suggested that they were recording it that evening, and turned to me and he said, would you like to play on it? He said, "We'll pay you a session fee." And wow. You know, session fee, that's more than a week's wages I was getting from Episode 6. So I did it, and that was the day they offered me the job.
Wow.
And of course, they weren't as dark and mysterious as my first impression of them was. John Lord, in fact, turned out to be such a gentleman. He was marvelous. I'm very impressed. Richie, of course, was dark and mysterious. But
well, he's always been
mysterious in those days.
You and Ian joined Deep Purple in 69 and debuted at the Speakeasy. What was the first appearance like, and how would you compare it to the concerto for group and orchestra?
The songs we were doing then, I mean, we had a couple of rehearsals, and strangely enough, I think in the very first rehearsal we came up with Speed King, and possibly Child in Time.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first couple of rehearsals, and that was before the Speakeasy. I don't know what songs we played at the Speakeasy. Certainly we would have played Mandrake Root, This Bird Has Flown. I think we did Help or Hey Joe.
Oh, so you were doing...
It was mostly the early stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it as being very crowded, even though Ian Gillan has a completely different version of the story. He says there weren't that many people there. But I remember people sitting in the aisles and sitting on the dance floor, and you couldn't move. It was hot and stifling and very loud.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember much of it, other than that being somewhat relieved that we'd done it. But I felt like I was one of the big boys. I guess that was my personal feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd been in clubs before. We played clubs a lot in Episode 6. But suddenly I felt, you know, one rung up on the ladder.
Okay, and... how would
but
you?
The concerto was a whole different experience. But by that time, I think we'd done four or five gigs by the time we did the concerto.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly they're in opposite directions. You know,
yeah.
Live, the band was loud and ferocious and aggressive and unpredictable. All the things that you don't need to be when you're working with an orchestra. And there was an undercurrent of resentment in the band towards John's work and towards the whole project. I never felt that. I mean, maybe because I was a new guy, I thought, wow, what a privilege, you know, to work with an orchestra. Wow, whatever you're doing, it can't be bad. But certainly there was I felt that undercurrent.
Mm-hmm.
That, it was John's thing. And certainly after all the press came out, hailing John as the, quote, leader and main composer of Deep Purple, that really got up Richie's nose.
I could imagine.
And I think, actually, and I've said this before, because of that experience, because of working with an orchestra, that's what made Deep Purple in Rock such a ferocious album.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a few gigs after that we did the concerto. I know one memorable one, we turned up and the guy said, well, where's the orchestra? So I think there was a kind of, we had an identity problem. Were we an arty band or were we a hard rock band?
Yeah. So,
and I think that's what we decided, that, yeah, we wanted to be a hard rock band, and that was that.
What inspired Deep Purple to go into a heavier musical direction?
I think the general feeling at the time was, I mean, this was after Hendrix and after Cream. And certainly when I joined the band, they'd heard Vanilla Fudge. And there was a feeling in the air. I think, you know, it's strange. I don't know how it works, but a lot of bands came up with similar things at the same time, you know, completely separate from each other.
Mm-hmm.
There was a feeling after Flower Power and all the airy fairy and the peace and love and good vibes thing that, you know, the gritty world was taking over again. It was industrial strength, you know, power.
Mm-hmm.
And let's push these instruments as hard as they'll go. I remember that feeling of playing your instrument as hard as you can play it and putting the VU meters in the red when you're in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
Just pushing, pushing, pushing. And I think part of that was the concerto, a reaction to the concerto, because we didn't want to, we wanted to make a stamp of what we were. And I think it was mostly Richie's doing, you know. Richie was very important at that time as pushing the band in the direction that he felt it should go in.
Oh, well, the first studio album, which featured the Mark II lineup, was In Rock, like we said, and it was released in June of 1970. What are your recollections of recording the first Mark II album?
We didn't do it in one studio. We did it in several different studios.
Mm-hmm. That I know.
We did it piecemeal. You know, we were working. We'd go off for 3 days and do gigs, come back, spend 2 days in the studio, go off for another week, come back and spend 3 days in the studio, that kind of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked at, I think, 3 or 4 different studios. We did one track at Air, 2 tracks at Delane Lee, I think 2 or 3 tracks at IBC.
And wow.
Maybe another studio somewhere, I can't remember. And Delane Lee was the last studio that we worked at. And actually, that was the turning point, because that's when we met Martin Birch. And that's when I think, particularly with the song Hard Loving Man, that we really found our identity.
Wow.
Such driving force, such determination, such as that live thing was actually captured in the studio. John turning his organ on and off and bashing it up and down, yeah, you know, which he did on stage, but he wouldn't do it in the studio, but he did.
Wow.
And it's very exciting. I mean, I actually loved that album.
Yeah, what would you say?
Partly because there's so much of me on it. It was a real turning point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Andy and Gillan's, you know, we come from a pop band into this, you know, free-thinking, hard-driving unit.
What would you say is your favorite tune off In Rock?
Well, I think Hard Loving Man is the one that sums it up. Yes, Child in Time is a great tune. And,
mm-hmm.
And Speed King's memorable, and there's lots of them.
Yeah,
Into
well,
the Fire. That was one of my riffs, Into the Fire. And,
I love Into the Fire. That's a great tune.
Richie said, you know, he'd heard some band, and the riff was chromatic.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it'd be nice to have a chromatic riff. And I said, what, something like this? And just played the first thing that came into my head. And of course, people joined in, and bang, there it was.
Okay.
So sometimes those instinctive moves are the best, you know.
In Rock became a huge hit and stayed on the UK charts for a year. The single Black Knight, which wasn't even included on the album, hit number 2 on the singles charts. Were you surprised by the success the band was having with a single which wasn't even on the record?
Yes. We'd actually given it up for No Hope. Because Black Knight came out, I think it was after the album,
mm-hmm.
but not long after. And, you know, I wasn't surprised by the success of Deep Purple in Rock. I was very pleased with it, and it was a very emotional time. First time I'd been in the charts, you know, whoom. That was pretty amazing. Black Knight was one of those afterthoughts that the management said, you know, you need a single, And I'm sure you've heard the story. We got drunk and had a bit of fun in the studio, never thinking it was going to be a single, and of course it was. And it came out and nothing happened. And we thought, well, probably right and proper. You know, we were an album band. We just want to concentrate on the albums. And it wasn't until, I don't know, 3 or 4 months later. In fact, we were in America, I think, doing the Hollywood Bowl with the concerto, when we got a message saying that Black Knight just went in the charts at number 28, and the following week it went to number 16 or something, and then boom, you know, just...
Wow.
It's a bit like... A match is a very small thing, but if you light it under a bonfire, all of a sudden, you know, the match is nothing anymore. It's just a bonfire. And that's what it felt like. We just, this little song that we were fooling around with in the studio when we were drunk, all of a sudden took a life of its own. I mean, just was a hit everywhere, all over Europe.
Wow.
A very heady feeling, I have to say. It's a wow, you know. I kept looking at the papers, the music papers, to see the name in the charts, just to reconfirm myself that it's actually really happening to us, you know. Simple pleasures.
Yeah, well, that's all you need.
It's like getting your name in the phone book, you know. Yes, I exist.
Okay. Fireball was released in July of 1971. The original UK version had Demon's Eye on its... as its third track, but on the American and Japanese version of the album, Strange Kind of Woman was the third track, and Demon's Eye was not even included. Why was there different versions of this album?
Don't know. That's the record company stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we considered ourselves an album band, first and foremost, and singles were a separate entity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a commercial prospect, that didn't please the Americans. They want the single on the album. And because albums had a certain time limit, I think, you know, Demon's Eye, unfortunately, was the one that got left off, and they put Strange Kind of Woman, which was never on the original Fireball album either,
mm-hmm.
in much the same way that Black Knight wasn't on In Rock. So, yeah.
Okay.
Mind you, Fireball came out, and that was on Fireball.
Yeah.
I think that was the follow-up. So I think Strange Kind of Woman came before that.
Oh, that's interesting. So, okay, well, during this period you suffered stress-related stomach pains and exhaustion, which resulted in your collapsing on stage. Were you feeling the pressures at this point to continue the success that the In Rock album had established?
I didn't think I was. I felt fine. I felt perfectly fine. It's just every time I got on stage, I'd have this pain in my side.
Mm-hmm.
And I've come to find out, there were a couple of... it was very painful. I remember one crawling under the table in the dressing room, you know, into a fetal position and just moaning.
Ooh.
Chaz Hodges played bass one night for the encore. He played Lucille. I think Black Knight and Lucille, I think, were the encores there. And I came off stage in such pain, he went on in my place.
Wow.
That was when we were touring with Heads, Hands and Feet.
Oh, that's a great band.
Yes, absolutely great. Anyway, it's come to find out it was unconscious tension. I eventually went to a hypnotherapist and never came back after that. Even after the first visit, it went away.
Okay.
So okay. I think it was unconscious tension, but I certainly didn't feel it myself. I felt fine. You know, I felt good.
Okay, well, the band traveled to Montreux, Switzerland in December of 1971 to write and record what would be Machine Head. Where did the band come up with the idea to travel to Montreux to record?
Machine Head was the result, really, of a direct result of our experience with Fireball. With Fireball, we went back to Delane Lee and Martin Birch, and this time did the entire album in one studio. But Delane Lee Kingsway was a basement. So the ceiling wasn't very high. It was a good studio, don't get me wrong, but it was kind of dead, as most studios were in those days. And Pacey was walking, he put a new snare head on his drum, and was tuning it up and playing it with a stick as he walked through the corridor into the studio. And the sound of the snare in the corridor was a big crack. And as he walked in the studio, it became a sort of dull thud. And so he had the idea of, why don't I set my drums up in the corridor? It'll give us that live sound. It's really kind of bright and sparkly. And that's what happened. He set his drums up in the corridor, which made it very difficult to get to the studio. You had to breathe in as you walked past. But the idea of, you know, at that time, live, the live shows were becoming electric and really powerful things. Nothing like, you know, records. A lot of extemporization, a lot of soloing, a lot of unrehearsed little detours. And there was a sort of feeling in the band that we wanted to capture that somehow. And the idea of recording a studio album in a live setting was really what we were after. So we were looking for some place, a theater or something like that, where we could use the stage and try and recreate that on-stage sound. But, of course, there wouldn't be an audience there, and we'd have the luxury of being able to repeat songs and so on. The casino at Montreux was a place that we'd played, and most bands played there. If they were doing a tour of Europe, they'd probably play there. It was a medium-sized auditorium, probably 2,000 seats or something like that. And it was available. Claude Nobbs, who ran it, I don't actually know who made the original call, probably the management office, looking to see what was available anywhere. And we also found out, by the way, that our accountant told us that if we wrote and recorded outside the country, it would be a tax saving. So there's also an incentive to do it out of England.
Mm-hmm.
So Montreux Casino happened to be free for 4 weeks.
Okay. How did the band meet Claude Nobbs?
Well, we'd worked before. We'd worked at the casino.
Mm-hmm.
He was... Montreux was a sleepy little town. It is still quite sleepy, but not so little anymore. But then it was a little backwater, really. It was quite beautiful, you know, around the lake and the mountains and
mm-hmm.
stunning place. And Claude was the man in town. I mean, he ran the casino. He ran all the bookings there. And usually when you played the casino, he would invite you to his home for either a meal or for coffee or for drinks or something like that. And he always had the most amazing apartment. He had the latest in audio gear. He was a real eclectic collector. Every piece of furniture, everything
wow.
hanging on the wall was amazing to look at.
That's cool.
He was one of those guys. And I always remember going to his apartment and just being just blown away with just the sound of his stereo system, for example. And he had a huge record collection. He was, you know, a real music nut. And you got to know him that way. And so when we said, you know, we'd like to come to Montreux and do an album, he was instrumental in sorting it all out for us.
Okay.
And when we arrived and got to the hotel, there was a bottle of wine and a T-shirt as a gift from Claude.
Oh, that's
in,
nice.
In each room. The T-shirt, it was a yellow T-shirt, said Montreux Pop on it.
Wow. That must be worth a fortune now.
And along with that, I mean, he came to the hotel and we had a drink, and he said, oh, by the way, he said, tomorrow there's one show. I think our roadies arrived that night, somewhere around about midnight they rolled up in the truck. And Claude said, well, you know, there's one more show to go before, you know, I'd suggest you don't put your gear in tonight. You leave it until after Frank Zappa's, you know, got his gear out, because he's
mm-hmm.
you know, got all the stuff on the stage. Made sense. So, of course, we didn't unload our gear, and we were invited to see the show the following afternoon, which, of course, is when the fire happened.
Yeah. Well, on the classic album DVD featuring Machine Head, you say Highway Star is the ultimate Deep Purple song. Most people consider Smoke on Water to be that song. What makes Highway Star your choice?
Well, people think it's Smoke on the Water because it's the most famous one.
Yeah.
I suppose. But to me, Highway Star exemplifies that hard rock, how hard rock was at the time. It was driving, it was melodic,
mm-hmm.
it was inventive. It's got the perfect words, you know, cars and girls. And some monumental playing. And the arrangement is, you know, at times almost classical. You know, there's Baroque changes in there. Other times it's just this machine gun, you know, it's but it's just a very exciting song. Smoke and the Water always seemed a bit slow to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the bass entry comes in and we sort of settle down into this dunk, 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 dunk. You know, it's fine, but it doesn't drive like Highway Star. Highway Star's got a real drive to it. And very difficult to write up songs.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier to write slower songs than it is to write fast songs.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that it's much easier to write songs about sadness and loss and pain rather than songs about love and happiness and good times.
Okay.
Because as soon as you start saying something about feeling good, it sounds syrupy.
Yeah.
Or sentimental. Or it's very difficult to capture that without sounding trite.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think Highway Star. I mean, it's a simple, honest, naive lyric. Nobody's going to take my car, you know. It doesn't get much more basic, and yet that's its strength.
Okay.
Nothing wrong with being basic.
Never Before was considered the first single off the album with When a Blind Man Cries as the B-side. Were you surprised by the hidden success of When a Blind Man Cries?
Not really. I mean, it's gone on to have a life of its own, which I'm very pleased about because I always liked the song.
Yeah, it's a great song.
And you know, given our druthers, it would be lovely to have had that on the album.
Mm-hmm.
But vinyl being what it was, you only had a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
Never Before was the one we thought was going to be successful. And we actually spent more time perfecting that than any other song. And of course, nothing happened to it. just shows what we know.
Yeah. The Made in Japan album, besides being hailed as one of the greatest live albums, also seemed to usher in other bands from later in the 70s to do live albums in Japan, like Cheap Trick, Live at Budokan, The Runaways Live in Japan, and Judas Priest Unleashed in the East, to name a few. Do you think that the success of Made in Japan inspired other bands to do live albums in Japan?
I suppose it did in some ways. I never actually thought about it, but why not? Certainly, from our point of view, going to Japan was a major excursion into somewhere exotic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by that time we'd done America and Europe pretty much to death. You know, traveled around everywhere. Going to Japan was somewhere really dark. Actually, I remember going in the management office for a band meeting one day. And they very proudly showed me an itinerary, which was the States, and then on to Japan. And I went, wow, Japan, great, wow. And everyone else in the band came in gradually and all said the same thing. Richie was the last to arrive. And he looked at it and put the paper back down on the desk and said, well, I'm not going to Japan. What? He said, I don't want to go there. And I, in my memory, think it was me, but it might not have been, said, well, you know, there's five of us in the band. How can you just say that? And he turned around and he said, well, I'm not stopping you from going. I just said, I'm not going.
Oh, my God.
He was talked into it eventually.
Mm-hmm.
I think with the promise of a holiday in Hawaii on the way.
Oh, my God.
Was the only way. But the second time we went from London, and I always remember we stopped in Moscow for a refuel, and I was quite thrilled to actually land in Moscow. I'd never been there before.
Mm-hmm.
Not that you saw much of it, we just saw the airport, but there was a place where they sold these small cups of coffee along with a sort of shot of vodka. And we had about 50 minutes to kill in the airport, so we got stuck into the vodka and the coffee, and by the time we got back on the plane, we were absolutely raving drunk. As only, clear vodka can make you.
Oh, yeah.
One minute you're normal, the next minute you're a rubber man. So the flight to Tokyo was spent, mostly sleeping and unconscious. And we arrived very hungover, with beards and baggy eyes, and stepped off the plane to see an army of fans and flowers and gifts and cameras and... The news cameras were there, you know. We were feeling so rough. I always remember that.
Okay.
Anyway. back to, did it influence them? I suppose it might have done. I don't know.
Well, I like the story anyway. Who cares? Who Do We Think We Are was released in January 73 in the U.S. and in February 73 in the U.K. You left the band after Gillan left, after the tour of Japan in 73. Why did you decide to leave the band at that time?
I didn't decide. It was decided for me. After Who Do We Think We Are, which is not an easy album to make, or a particularly pleasant album, although it had its good points, it's very difficult working with a band where two guys just don't talk to each other and actually don't want to see each other.
Wow. I suppose I know who those two were.
On opposite ends of the poles. And it was uncomfortable. And touring, we worked on stage. They worked together. They'd actually look at each other, but nothing would pass between them. And Richie started showing up late or not showing up or making his own plans or just deciding where and when he'd do an encore without any reference to anyone else in the band. And I think that, of course, that's annoying, but it really got up Gillan's nose. And he decided to act as irrationally as Richie seemed to be acting, which made things even worse. Mm-hmm. And Gillan was obviously very unhappy with the situation and wrote his, his famous his letter saying he was leaving the band. It was widely supposed at that time that Richie was going to leave as well and take Pacey with him, which left John and I, John Lord and I. And I remember in January of 73, the two managers called me up and said, we'd like to go out to dinner with you and John. And we went out to dinner to some place in Fulham or Chelsea or somewhere like that. Nice restaurant. And they said, look, Richie's probably going to leave with Pacey. Gillan's, given his notice in by letter. Deep Purple is, probably the biggest band in the world at the moment. It seems such a shame. Would you two like to consider carrying on? If you can get Pacey to stay with you, even better. But it seems like Richie's gone and Gillan's gone, so, what are we going to do? And we agreed, I had no reason to want the band to finish then.
Mm-hmm.
So we shook hands on it and said, we'll do our best. And a week or so later, we were on tour in Scandinavia, I think, and John and I approached Pacey and said, look, we know you're thinking about leaving and going with Richie. But, Deep Purple still got something to offer. Look at the success we've had. Why don't you stay? And he said, well, I'll think about it. And that was the last I heard for months and months and months until sometime in May, I suppose. We were on tour in America. And I just had this feeling that no one was talking to me anymore. There was no banter. There was no camaraderie. It was just down to business. And I kind of felt something was up. And that when we played Madison Square Garden, Glenn Hughes came that night. And I really didn't know anything about it. I just had an awful feeling somehow. And there's a photograph taking me in the dressing room after the show, which says it all. It's so depressing, this photograph.
Wow.
Exhausted, beaten up, cigarette in one hand, beer in the other, wet from the stage, looking like death. Anyway, a couple of weeks later, one of the managers used to take turns in coming on the road with us, and this time it was Tony Edwards. And it was after the show in Jacksonville. We were staying in a motel somewhere. I banged on his door half an hour or so after we got back from the gig, and he answered the door, and I said, what's going on? He said, what are you talking about? I said, something's going on. He said, no, he said, what are you talking about? I said, can I come in? He said, yeah. So I went in. I said, I'm not leaving this room until you tell me the truth. Because I know something's going on. I just, at least give me the respect of telling me what's going on. And eventually he gave in. He said, well, Richie's decided he'd stay with the band as long as you go.
Oh.
What's up? That's nice to know.
God, that's terrible.
And how do the others feel about that? I said, well, they think it's a good idea. I see. So I said, well, so how come no one told me? And they said, well, we wanted to finish this tour. You know, it's worth a lot of money, and we didn't want you walking out in the middle of a tour. And I said, well, I'll show you who the gentleman is here. I'll work out the rest of the tour, and when it finally ends in Japan, I'll do those, and I'll do it as well as I can. But you're not firing me. I submit my resignation as of now. And that was accepted. And, of course, later on, I wished I'd let them fire me, because now I can sue them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, I don't know. But it was not a happy time. I felt very alone and very uncomfortable. I mean, you make the best of it, and you know, I still...
Yeah.
I had a long chat with John Lord on the plane going to Japan for that last tour.
Wow.
And after the meal, we both had wives and girlfriends with us. After the meal, I said, John, can I talk to you alone? And we talked alone, and I said, you know, well, I said what I said.
Yeah.
I didn't